Next case for argument, Bank of America versus Velashami, Mr. McQueen.
Presiding Judge Posner, Your Honors, may it please the Court. The appeal here today arises from the deprivation of liberty of Mr. and Mrs. Velashami to travel internationally without due process arising from civil litigation. The Supreme Court, as early as 1958 in Kent versus Dulles, made clear that judges cannot immobilize civil litigants.
Buy any of that. Look, there'd be nothing objectionable to a preliminary injunction preventing people from transferring money to a foreign country.
Certainly agree with that, Your Honor.
Well, suppose they put it in their pockets and they fly off with the money. You can't stop them from doing that because of the right to travel?
Well,
what sense does that make?
Your Honor, the fact of the citation...
Right, suppose I'd like to transfer $1 million to Andorra. But instead, I cash a large check, I stuff the $1 million in my suitcase, and I fly off there. And you say that can't be stopped because that's the right to travel. That's ridiculous.
No, I'm not saying that the travel is the issue. In that case, the fact of the injunctive relief arising from the previously served citation gives rise to the implication of the court's authority over the traveler not to make any transfer of monies, and that is controlled there. If the traveler then did that...
But the point is that whether it's the person or the wired money doesn't make any difference. Yes, there has to be process of some sort in either case. You don't get any mileage from talking about right to travel.
Well, Your Honor, in this case, the surrender of the passports has been ordered. There has been injunctive relief entered declaring that the appellants may not travel internationally. Now, the status of the...
They may not run off to India to prevent their creditors from getting any of this money. Now, it seems to me your only valid complaint is that Judge Shader didn't give you enough process, and there are serious doubts about whether Velashamis are engaged in fraud, right? Isn't that your argument? You say they just didn't pay their debts. They're not engaged in fraud. That's just an argument about the evidence and whether the process that Judge Shader underwent was adequate, right?
Exactly right. And it certainly wasn't adequate, it seems to me, under the circumstances in terms of...
Well, did you ask him for a fuller hearing?
Your Honor, the...
Did you ask him for a fuller hearing?
We did. And we objected both
what
at the...
What did he say?
He continued the matter until 2:30 in the afternoon to give a further opportunity for counsel to review the pleadings which had been delivered by hand the morning of the 11 o'clock hearing, and he entered his order at 2:30.
Okay, he enters his order. Now, after he entered, which would, I think is in the nature of a temporary restraining order. So he enters that. Now, what discussion was had about a fuller hearing in order to extend this temporary restraining order?
After that hearing at 2:30, there was no discussion. The content of the order set forth the bases upon which the Velashamis could have the liberty restraint lifted. They could pay the money. They could do various things. Those items were all set forth in the written order signed and entered of record on March 18th. But it seems to me that the failure...
You wanted something more. You wanted to challenge the evidence. So did you ask for a hearing on the evidence?
We did not, Your Honor. We did not.
Was that a serious omission?
The serious omission, it seems to me, is that the...
I think you've gotten mesmerized by the right to travel, whereas I see this as just a simple case about what kind of procedure was necessary in order to enter after this initial, you know, very summary procedure, in effect, the preliminary injunction.
And it seems to me...
requires a hearing, but could have asked for a hearing.
Well, it seems to me that we did ask for a hearing. We got the hearing that apparently the district court felt was necessary at 2:30 that afternoon.
That wasn't much of a hearing.
It certainly wasn't.
Well, why didn't you ask for a fuller hearing? You could say to the judge, now I realize you had to act very quickly. And that's why I say the analogy is to the temporary restraining order and the preliminary injunction. Had to act quickly, but now we want a regular, you know, evidentiary hearing.
Your Honor, the court in its decision at 2:30 on the 18th failed to, in our view, adequately focus upon the fact that as of the presentation of this emergency motion to him, there had been no order violated. There had been no finding of contempt.
That doesn't matter.
Those are certainly considerations that should underpin, based upon this court's decision in Herbstein.
No. You get a temporary restraining order because you think something bad is about to happen. You don't have to have a finding of anything, right? You don't need a contempt finding in order to issue a temporary restraining order.
No, but under this court's decision in Herbstein, that is one of the considerations in civil litigation as to whether...
It's always civil litigation when we're talking about temporary restraining orders. You don't go... Right?
It is.
And it doesn't require a finding of contempt. It just requires... A situation where you want to freeze the status quo for up to 10 days, or I guess it can be extended to 20 days, but up to 10 days, and then at the end of that, you have to have a hearing. So you could have said to Judge Shader, okay, this is like a temporary restraining order, and you know we understand you have to act quickly, but we want an evidentiary hearing.
Well, it seems to me, Your Honor, under this court's teaching in Herbstein versus Brutman, there had to be something more before that.
Why?
Because
you agreed that there's no difference between wiring the money and taking the money in your pockets, right? And if there's no difference, then the same procedures should apply.
Well. But
you're going to go back to this right to travel business.
As this court indicated in Herbstein, Your Honor.
Clinging to Herbstein.
Well,
look, do you think Herbstein meant to say that there are two completely different procedures when you're stopping a person from taking money or stopping the money from going there?
Herbstein certainly said, Your Honor.
Would it make sense to have the same procedures?
Herbstein certainly said that there are considerations when you're focusing upon the defendant and the defendant's conduct in the civil litigation. Those are the considerations which we argue Judge Shader failed adequately to review before entering this order. As I say, there had, in this case, never been a failure to appear. There had never been any flight to avoid litigation, as there had been in Herbstein. No order of the court had been violated, as there had been in Herbstein, and indeed there had been a finding of contempt in Herbstein. There had not been a refusal of cooperation with the court, as there had been in Herbstein. And so the district
court... How about
the
discovery and that sort of thing?
Judge, let me address that. On January 25th, when the interveners appeared, Judge Shader ordered that the Veluchamis produce various documents that dealt with the intervention. I addressed the court then and indicated to the court that we would be asserting our Fifth Amendment rights. And the judge set a schedule. He said, file a brief and your underlying factual assertion by February 8th. On February 1st, I appeared with the Veluchamis before Judge Shader in response to the citation and indicated then that we would be asserting the Fifth Amendment with respect to the citations. And he told me to make that part of my presentation on February 8th. We did that. On March 2, after the bank had replied, we appeared before Judge Shader, and he indicated that he would consider the issue of the Fifth Amendment, but wanted to give us an opportunity to speak with the United States Attorney to see if we could get any relief there. We did not. When we did not, he indicated that he would not authorize a blanket assertion of the Fifth Amendment. He would provide us some protection in an order. That occurred on March 9. That order was actually...
That protection seemed kind of curious to me, too. Wasn't Judge Shader saying that he wouldn't even disclose to the U.S. Attorney's Office the answers to those questions?
Yes, Judge.
Can he do that?
I believe that he can make an effort to allow civil litigants to respond to citation proceedings and...
He can give immunity?
He isn't, in fact, I don't believe he's giving immunity by that, Judge. He is simply...
What has
a protective order in place which governs that testimony.
So your clients would give sworn testimony that would not be disclosed even to a government subpoena, grand jury subpoena.
Until further order of the court.
And you would agree to that?
I did agree to that, Judge.
You did agree to that.
All right. My time is run.
You know, the problem with Herbstein... Look how it starts off. As for the merits of Brutman's appeal, it is to laugh. And then he explains Brutman could have been imprisoned, right? Because he had committed contempt. So this is an a fortiori case. The court is not exploring the limits of the authority of a judge to withhold people's passports, right? So you put too much weight on it. Anyway, you'll get it. I'll give you a chance to reply.
Thank you, Judge.
Mr. Royne.
Thank you, Judge. May it please the court. My name is Howard Rowan, and I represent the plaintiff, Bank of America. Your Honor, if I could start, I'd like to start by addressing the due process argument that was raised, the procedure argument.
No. What I want to know is what you think is the appropriate procedure in a case like this. You're worried about someone absconding, so you ask that his passport be sequestered. So what next? What does he have to do to get his passport back?
Your Honor, I believe the procedure here was appropriate.
That's not my question. I'm asking you what should the procedure be?
The procedure should be that the person whose passport is taken can come back at any time and make a showing that they're entitled to get their passport back through any of a number of reasons. One of them is the reason that the defendant stated at the hearing, that the transfers were all legitimate payment of debts out of
the country. Should the procedure be different from that with a temporary restraining order and preliminary injunction? Why shouldn't it be identical? This is, in effect, a preliminary injunction, right? It prevents them from leaving the country.
That's what made it appealable, Your Honor.
Well, shouldn't there be an evidentiary hearing?
That was offered to the defendants. The district court said they can come back at any time. He anticipated, if you look at the transcript of the hearing, he determined from the defendants that they were not going to be leaving the country at all until sometime in May, which was 6 weeks away. And the discussion was the judge said, look, come back at any time, and we can get this done before anybody's leaving. So the due process rights are protected. The right to travel to the extent there is one is protected. And I know what we all thought when we were there, which is we got an emergency order. It wasn't like in Dexia, an ex parte order, but we got an emergency order And the court said, look, you're not leaving for a while. Let's get this over with before anybody's thinking of leaving. But the defendants didn't want to do it that way. They wanted the argument that they're making to this court. They made a strategic decision not to ask for a hearing. That's not a violation of due process. And from a practitioner's point of view, I think this procedure is exactly right. Instead of saying, we had a lot of discovery to do, instead of saying to the defendants, you need to prove your point in 10 days or I'm holding your passport through a preliminary injunction hearing, the district court said, basically, get your ducks in a row, and when you're ready, come in and show me that this is okay. It's been 6 weeks. We submitted an affidavit. We submitted the documents on March 16th. It's been 6 weeks, and the defendants have not come in to the district court to say word one about why their $25 million of transfers are okay. They haven't done that. Their rights were not violated. And I think this procedure is just fine. I mean, I acknowledge that the court could have said, we're going to have a hearing in 10 days or 2 weeks. But all that wouldn't have affected due process. All that affects is whether the order is appealable or not. The judge instead said to them, look, come back whenever you want. And they didn't want, because they wanted this argument. But
were
that's
there substantial
not
assets by these parties in financial institutions here?
No. I mean, let me rephrase that, Your Honor. There were, according to the financial statements given to us when the loans were made and the extensions were made, tens of millions of dollars, excluding the failed bank. There were also some $50 million in India. What we discovered, which was the reason for our emergency motion, was we discovered that everything got shipped out that could be shipped out. North of $25 million went cash through their bank accounts in the U.S. to bank accounts in India. And then we knew they already had some $50 million in India. We also found that they had recently gotten India identity cards that allowed them to work there, to live there forever. We found that Mr. Velashami resigned from the businesses here, we thought, so he could run them over there. And we already knew he'd been asserting the Fifth Amendment. So we looked at all that and we thought, it's almost impossible to imagine a case where someone looks like a greater flight risk. And to address the point, the district court's
work. How would it help you in collecting the money that you're owed to have him here rather than there?
Your Honor, Illinois statute, Section 214.02, authorizes a lot of very powerful remedies. One of those remedies is to say to someone who's here, you must deliver up your property. While, and even though his property is in India, he is subject to an order from the district court that says, bring it back.
What if he disobeys the order?
That's contempt, and he can go to jail. But it's not enforceable if he's in India. And what the miscarriage of justice here that Judge Shader was addressing that we were concerned about was that we would get to a point in the case where the district court says, look, I've seen that you've transferred all this money. I see you have this money, and I don't buy the transfers. I want the money back. We want that order to be enforceable. We don't want deafening silence from India, because that's where they are.
In that civil matter, there's no way to get it back.
There's no way to get it back except an order to the party to bring it back.
No, and I mean, if he were there.
If he were there, you know, we could order, but it would be like Herbstein. We'd have to wait and see if he stumbled back into the country and somebody grabbed him. We didn't want to wait that long. Judge Shader didn't want to wait that long. So, you know, this case, there's a continuum. My opponent talked about how you have to have contempt in order to have one of these orders that you take a passport. But that's not really right. There's a continuum in the cases. The cases they cite are almost all prejudgment cases. And the cases they cite, none of them involve massive transfers to a foreign country where there's no way the money can get back. Then the other end of the continuum is the Herbstein case, in which you have a post-judgment case like ours, and you have someone who's obviously a flight risk. The way to look at this case is, you know, where are we on the continuum? And I think it's obvious that we're on the Herbstein end of the continuum. And a good way to look at that is look at the opinion written by then Judge Stevens in the Shaheen case back when he reversed Julius Hoffman. In that case, it went, you know, the opposite of our way. He said that Julius Hoffman was wrong in grabbing the passport. But if you look at the reasons Justice Stevens gave, those reasons are exactly the opposite of what we have here. Justice Stevens said it's prejudgment. There's no judgment yet. He said there's no evidence of money being transferred to a foreign country. He said there's no evidence of assets in a foreign country. And he said there's no evidence that there isn't any money left here. That's a case when you say you can't take a passport. The evidence presented to Judge Shader, totally unrebutted 6 weeks later, is that all four of those things are our way. We have a $43 million judgment. We have massive transfers to India, massive. We have, although, you know, now they take the Fifth Amendment on this, we have financial statements showing $50 million worth of assets in India, and we have no money left in their name in the United States. Frankly, I can't imagine a stronger case than we have here for the district court doing what he did. So I urge the court to affirm the district court's order. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Rowan. Mr. McQueen.
Judge, if I may make two brief points, and I appreciate the court giving me this additional time. First, with respect to the Indian document which the clients have obtained, that relates to a new law allowing for easier travel in and out of the country by Indian citizens, and has only been in existence for a little more than a year. Secondly, with respect to the very large transfers, and certainly the record is clear, there were very large transfers of monies from my clients to their Canara Bank account in India. But the fact of the matter, as the bank well knows, is very nearly $20 million of those dollars have been repatriated to the United States in the accounts of the adult children of the defendants.
Do the Velashamis have Indian citizenship as well? They're U.S. citizens.
They are U.S. citizens. And my understanding, Judge Tinder, is they maintain their natural citizenship from the homeland where they were born. Thank you very much for the additional time.
What about Mr. Rowan's point that you've had 6 weeks to ask for an evidentiary hearing? And
quite frankly, Judge, at this point, the clients have undergone 5 full days of deposition. The bank now has spread of record in their testimony over very nearly 30 hours. The factual underpinnings of their various financial transactions. At this point, it doesn't seem to me that we advance the ball at all by going back to the district court and asking for a lengthy evidentiary hearing until we have completed that citation process and all of the evidence has been presented about these financial transactions. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Thank you to both counsel.